I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Howard White joins me again. We're going to talk books with Howard, which is hardly a big surprise, as he's an accomplished and prize-winning author in his own right, as well as with Mary White. He operates Harbor Publishing. We'll talk about at least three books now, two that Mr. White has written and that have been re-released with new editions, and a third, which he's published, one we've already talked about on the program this past week with Alan Garr, and one that Howard and I spoke about a year ago on the death of the historian Chuck Davis. That book, The Chuck Davis History of Metropolitan Vancouver, has just been released, and it's a very fine achievement. There's a book launch this Tuesday, the 6th of December, at the Vancouver Public Library. A book that Howard White wrote in 1983 has recently been reissued as part of the Vancouver 125 Legacy book series. Brad Cran was on the program a couple of months ago to talk about the series, and Howard's A Hard Man to Beat is one of those books. It's an oral history that Howard put together with Bill White, a labor leader, historian, shipyard worker, and from this book, in his own voice, a hell of a raconteur. Bill White was a labor leader in the 1940s and 50s when shipbuilding was a booming industry on this coast. The book is a history of those times. The other book we'll discuss is Howard's second edition of The Sunshine Coast. It's a very handsome book that'll make any coffee table look smart, what with its wonderful photographs of the scenic 100-mile stretch of BC's waterfront from Howe Sound to Desolation Sound, with Gibson's in the south and Powell River in the north. Dean Van Schip does the photography for this revised edition. A Hard Man to Beat, the story of Bill White, and The Sunshine Coast from Gibson's to Powell River are from Harbor Publishing, who also publish The Chuck Davis History of Metropolitan Vancouver. HarborPublishing.com is the website for more. In Madeira Park on BC Sunshine Coast this day, please welcome back to the Planta Online program, Howard White.
Good morning, Mr. White.
Hi.
Let me catch my breath.
Yeah, that was quite an intro. Hardly leaves us anything to talk about.
Yeah, but how are you?
I'm fine.
Yeah.
This is always a fun time of year for us when all the stuff we've been laboring on in obscurity all year finally hits the deck, and we get to see people responding to it and get to talk about it. So it's the fun part of publishing.
Yeah, you've had a good year, haven't you? I mean, the Grant Lawrence book, I mean, that was a big hit.
Yep.
I read some of the Mike McArdle book as a national bestseller.
Yes, it is. It's on the national BookNet Canada nonfiction list.
Really?
Number six or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, do people know about McArdle outside of this part of the world?
Well, they've come to know about him. This is about his 10th book now.
Yeah.
So they get distributed across the country, and of course, outside of his broadcasting area here, he's mostly known as a writer. And funny thing about Mike is that he's actually a really good writer.
He is, yeah.
Yeah.
I guess we'll start with the Davis book. The reception for that that's gotten off pretty well, hasn't it?
It's taken off now. New books, when they first come out, they always sit there for a week or two, and you sort of bite your nails and you wonder, is anybody going to come and get this book? But the word of mouth has obviously been really terrific on it, and it's starting to fly now. And there's one very tiny bookstore in North Vancouver bought five cases to begin with because they had a signing.
Yeah.
And before the signing came up, they phoned and ordered another seven cases because they'd sold them all.
Wow.
Even before. And, you know, that's not even in downtown Vancouver. That's in
exactly.
North Vancouver. So
yeah.
I think that book is going to be a runaway.
Yeah, and I was talking to Alan Garr about it last week. It's a book that I've been, I mean, I got the book at that thing at the Hotel Georgia a couple weeks ago.
Right, yeah.
And I haven't been able, it's still on my desk here. And
I
go to it, you know, 5 minutes a day, an hour a day.
It seems,
you know,
almost like a guilty indulgence to read it because it's so entertaining and you can just keep flipping back and forth. You don't have to try and follow any themes or inform yourself. You can just enjoy it.
Yeah, and it's a book that I like, for me at least, and I'm sure for a lot of people, it's a book that we'll be going through the rest of our lives, I think.
Yeah, it puts a lot of things together. I like just looking back over even some of the more recent years and saying, oh, that's when that happened. Okay, yeah. And then that's how that news story ended up. I never did hear the end of that one. And, you know, it puts a lot of things together for you.
Yeah. Now, a hard man to beat. You wrote that in 1983?
Is that when it was?
God, yeah.
That's a long time ago.
This was your first book, was it?
Yeah. First prose book.
Prose book.
I think I wrote a book of poetry in that same year. I was publishing with Pulp Press, as it was called then, before it became Arsenal Pulp Press.
And so you weren't related to Bill White, right?
No. He was a neighbor here in this small town of Pender Harbor, but the names were just a coincidence.
Now, was he well known at the time, like in the 80s when this book first came out?
No, he had been completely forgotten. Like a lot of labor leaders, I think even more than politicians, once they're out of office, they completely drop out of sight. So I'd really never heard of him as a labor leader at all. I just knew him as this loudmouthed guy that used to show up at community meetings and sound off about the perfidies of the capitalist system and that kind of thing. And there was a big rumor that he had been something sometime in the labor movement, but it had pretty well all been forgotten, and his own union did what they could to erase all memory of it as well, because he as often happens when one regime ends, the regime that takes over are sort of the first regime's opponent, so they sort of like a banana republic. They try and erase all the record of the previous administration, and that's kind of what happened in his case.
So how did you come about to writing this?
Well, it was an interesting story. I didn't intend to write about it. He wanted me to write a book, but he wanted it to be about the time before he was a labor leader, and he had been then an RCMP serving in the Arctic, and he'd sailed on the St. Rock, the famous RCMP patrol ship that was the first boat to circumnavigate North America, and at least in both directions. And he'd been on the ship, and he'd been on shore, and he'd done some famous long dog sled trips chasing murderers. He was sort of one of the Mounties that helped to establish that saying that the Mountie always gets their man.
Yeah.
And it was a good story, and in the end it actually did get written, but not by me. My son wrote it, but many, many years later. And we started off listening to those stories, but I noticed that the thing that Bill really liked to talk about was his labor days, and he'd get sidetracked all the time and start talking about his days of being in the shipyards in Vancouver during the war, when Vancouver was practically taken over by the shipbuilding program during the war years. There was 30,000 people working in, I think, six different shipyards.
Mm-hmm.
They had several temporary shipyards built down on False Creek, and the rest were over on the North Shore. Burrard, of course, was the biggest one. And he was just out of work, so he got work in those yards. And then being a loud person and a independent thinker, he soon found himself dominating union meetings and got elected president, and rode the union as it grew to be the biggest local union in Canada. And he remained leader of that union, I think he won 11 straight presidential elections and finally left it in the mid-50s. So he saw the wartime shipbuilding program build up, die down, and he sort of saw the modern labor movement take hold, because most of the things we take for granted about, Union Hall hiring and the closed shop and the 40-hour week and so on, these were, and particularly his big thing was safe working conditions, mm-hmm. which didn't exist in the yards at first. So those sort of things came in during the war and during the post-war years and became sort of standard working realities during that period, and he was prominent in bringing those about.
Now, we're building ships again, I guess, in these parts shortly. Not as big.
Not as big, no.
No.
No, we're going to be building one or two a year, and look at how proud we are of that. Just think what Vancouver was like when we were building. We were launching one a week.
Wow.
And these were seagoing freighters, mm-hmm. much bigger than the ships we're going to be building now.
The book was selected as part of this 125 Legacy book series. When you found out about that, I mean, was that, what's that like?
Well, that was nice. I'd always liked the book. It was my first one, and it had pretty much come out the way I'd wanted it to. And it had gotten quite a lot of attention at the time, mainly because we got Bill White on the Jack Webster program, which uh-huh. was the big noise in town in those days.
Right.
And they really hit it off. They'd known each other back in the Union days anyway. And as a result of that, the book got quite well known. I think it went through 3 printings. And that was a long time ago, and it had died out and pretty well been forgotten to the world. And I never expected it to be back in the stores again. And so it was really nice when the Vancouver 125 committee chose it as one of the 10 books that deserved republication and paid for it to be republished. And here it is back to life again.
Yeah, why do you think they chose it? And I mean, we sort of know what their mandate is, that they want to bring these books back to tell us about ourselves. Is there much relevance today with this book, do you think?
Well, there was kind of a relevance I don't think they even intended, because almost the same day that it was released, this new shipbuilding program
yeah. mm-hmm.
was announced, and there was a whole lot of talk about British Columbia's role as a shipbuilding province, which is one of the main themes of that book. BC had geared up and become one of the shipbuilding centers of the world in the Second World War. And then after the war ended, despite all kinds of government good intentions, and promises that they would maintain that lead in shipbuilding, they let the industry pretty well dwindle to nothing. Burrard Inlet, Burrard Dry Docks eventually closed, and the big one in Victoria closed, and we were pretty much out of the game. And then all of a sudden, with this latest program, we're reviving some of that history. So that made the book unintentionally kind of relevant. But I think, you know, that was one of our proudest moments as a city and a province, that we were able to step up and in 4 wartime years go from 0 to 300 seagoing ships almost overnight, and with mostly untutored help, I think third of the workforce or quarter of it or some large number were women, because all the guys were over in Europe. And it was an amazing accomplishment and something that we've sort of forgotten. So I think probably the committee thought that was something that deserved to be brought back, and I hope they also thought it was a good read, a good book.
You know, he died 10 years ago, Bill did. Mm-hmm. What did he think of the book at the time?
Oh, well, he really enjoyed being back in the limelight. He had retired to Pender Harbor and spent all his time salmon fishing, and I think he was getting good and bored doing that. And so when the book came out and he got on Jack Webster, suddenly he was in demand everywhere, and he was doing radio interviews everywhere, and he was really getting a big kick out of it. And of course, he always had numerous axes to grind. He was just a really politically involved guy. So he was able to, have one last kick at all his old enemies in the labor movement and in the political establishment, and sound off about the decline of the shipping industry or the shipbuilding industry and all those things. And he really enjoyed that. I don't think he ever stopped to think about the literary quality of the book or anything like that. I think he just looked at it and he thought, well, you know, that's me, that's the story I told, let's go with it. I don't think he ever stopped to think about some of the things I talk about in the introduction there of my difficulties in taping him and then straightening out all the jumbled chronology of his storytelling and putting it into words or any of that. He wasn't a very schooled kind of a guy, and he just thought, well, those are my words and this is my book, and that's all there is to it.
Did you keep in touch with him over the years?
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, he was a good friend, and he lived to be 93, was it? Something like that. 93, yeah. 94. And his wife eventually died, and he was on his own, but he still lived in this area. And finally, in the last years, he went to an old age home in Ladner, I believe it was. But I'd go down and visit him once in a while, and we always had a good chat. And he'd always be right up to date on all the latest headlines and political doings, and have numerous strong opinions, which he would vent at length.
So he retired to the Sunshine Coast, and this leads to the next book. Who makes up the population of the Sunshine Coast? Is it mainly retirees, or?
It's a very mixed population, and that's one of the very first things I deal with in the book, because that's the first thing that everybody asks.
Yeah, we have a perception of the place. You know,
what the heck do people do up there? I mean, there's one pulp mill, quite a small pulp mill, but it's the only smokestack industry we have, and it employs, oh, I think 200 or 300 people, but there's 30,000 altogether. So what the heck do they do? And it's always been a place where people kind of, did for themselves. They do a little of this and a little of that, and there's a fair sized service industry now because there's a lot of retirees living here, so there's a fair-sized construction industry building new homes for people. But it's the old style still carries on to a degree, because there isn't a basic economy here that runs 9 to 5. Mm-hmm. Most people up here maybe do a bit of construction, maybe do a bit of fishing in the summer, commercial fishing, fishing prawns, or going out on a halibut run or something like that, or a spot of logging now and then. Quite a large arts and crafts community where they do pottery or glass blowing or painting and sell this in the local galleries during the summer when the tourists come up. And nobody's living very high, except some of the retirees have come in and built multi-million dollar mega homes, but we get by and we like it up here.
Yeah. Now, if one wanted to go up to where Harbor's at, I don't drive, so I'm wondering what the commute is like. Is that
pretty well beyond the range of of the public transit universe? We do have BC Transit buses up here now, but they only come halfway up the Sunshine Coast. They sort of peter out about Half Moon Bay, and we're another 20 miles beyond that in Pender Harbor. So you'd have to hitchhike.
Yeah. So you're coming to Vancouver for this Davis launch, for example.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that'll end sometime in the evening, late evening. Uh-huh. So do you go home? I mean, do you drive back? Or is there do you have to take a ferry? How does that work?
Yeah, we take ferries, the ferries don't run as late now as they used to. They used to run till 11 o'clock at night, so we could take in an event like the one at the library.
Yeah.
I think it starts at, when does it start?
Seven,
yeah.
Yeah.
So we could spend a couple hours there and then pack our bags and dash up to Horseshoe Bay and be there in time for the final 11 o'clock sailing. But now the last sailing is at 9, so you can't do that. You have to stay over.
Now we're
if you have an evening event. It's really close to Vancouver, and yet it's sort of a different world.
Yeah. And this is a second edition of the book. When did it originally come out? I guess in the 90s sometime?
They say 15 years ago, so I guess 96.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem that long ago, but we did really well with it. We actually sold more of it than we did it's part of a series where we do a little history and a little travel information, little sort of prose profile of an area,
yeah,
together with a lot of really great color photos. And we've done that for Courtney, Comox, Campbell River, Victoria, a whole bunch, Whistler, a bunch of different towns. And this is one of the smallest places we've done it for, and yet it's been one of the most successful, I think, just because nobody's ever written a book like that about the Sunshine Coast before. And it was getting a little long in the tooth, and I started flipping through the pages the other day and thought, wow, that building's not there anymore. Gee, the main street of Seashell doesn't look anything like this anymore.
Yeah.
So we decided to redo it, and I didn't write an entire new text for it, but I updated the one that was there, and we put all new photos. So it doesn't have, I think there's maybe one photo in it from the 96 edition. All the rest are taken mainly by Dean Van Skip, who's a wonderful photographer that lives in Roberts Creek.
I mispronounced it, I guess, in my intro.
Yeah, most people do.
Yeah. Is it affordable, like in terms of living where you live, compared to Vancouver?
Yeah.
We talk about Vancouver as terribly expensive, but
we think the prices are terrible here now because you can't really get much of a house for under $300,000 anymore. But lots and lots of people, just ordinary folks living in Vancouver, who've had their house appreciate up to, you know, $1.5 million are able to sell out, mm-hmm. come up here, buy a really much newer and better home, and bank enough to retire on. So people coming up from the Lower Mainland actually find it very affordable. As for us, we bought our first home when we first got married for $32,000. So looking at our kids buying them now for $450,000, it seems just unthinkable. But in the big picture, it's still pretty affordable. And of course, that's the biggest cost. The overheads and the living costs here are a lot less, people find, once they move up here.
And you guys, you've lived there since the 50s, is my understanding, right?
Yeah. I've now passed 60 years here in the Sunshine Coast.
And you couldn't live anywhere else?
I never saw any reason to try.
Yeah.
That's a lie. When I was growing up here, I thought it was the rear end of the universe, and I couldn't wait to get out of the place. But after traveling around and seeing a bit of the rest of the world, I came to the conclusion it wasn't such a bad place after all.
Howard, it's been great speaking again, and good luck with all these books. It sounds like it's been a great season at Harbor, and I hope it continues.
Yeah, it's certainly looking up, and we're having fun with all these new books, and it's always a treat to talk to you, Joe.
Thanks very much. The website for more, harborpublishing.com. Howard White on the line from Madeira Park, British Columbia in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.